week for him?
Next year, I'll just move down to the hot seat.
I'll just read through my quick summary of evidence here. Obviously focused on the gondola. Global data highlights the continued demand for gondola installations around the world as destinations seek to broaden visitor experiences while also focusing on more sustainable forms of transportation, especially in areas where vehicular access is constrained. A review of the literature on gondola-related impacts globally highlights a number of positive and negative impacts related to those gondolas. I've summarised those in the table presented there. You can see the positive impacts which far outweigh the negatives in terms of the weight of discussion and literature tend to be focusing on elements like the linkage and development of other centres and poles along the route of the gondola, the development of service-related facilities at gondola stations, the employment generated during the construction and operation phases, the fact that visitors may stay longer or spend more in a destination where a gondola is featured, and the gondola may in some cases become a feature or an attraction in itself, reduction in travel time to destinations, and obviously economic efficiency benefits that go along with that, enhanced visitor experience, the broadening of all-season appeal of destinations that has perhaps traditionally been focused on winter activities, the ability to provide soft adventure experiences, transport that's less affected by snow and on-ground conditions and roads, reductions in traffic congestion and associated car parking footprints, reduction in GHG and CAP emissions, and relatively safe transportation system. The negative impacts, which are certainly reviewed there in the literature as well, reduction in traffic flow can sometimes lead to impacts on local economies and businesses. Crowding and commercialisation can be a factor that has to be managed around the development of the poles associated with gondolas. There is obviously some impact on wilderness and backcountry recreational values and some evidence of aesthetic impact. Gondolas can be more affected by wind and electrical storms than roads, although the wind effect is not as great as some people might assume. Construction brings negative environmental impacts, including noise, traffic, and soil erosion, plus some loss of forest and other habitats. So these are examples taken from around the world. The proposed gondola development is well positioned to benefit from predicted increases in both the number of visitors and also the yield of visitors travelling to New Zealand and Queenstown in the coming years. The proposed Remarkables gondola experience will fit well with the deeper experiential dimensions needed to enhance yield from existing and new markets. By yield, I really just mean visitor expenditure. Adding value to the ski field visitor by cutting travel times and challenges related to road transport, while also deepening the range of all-season travel experiences for non-snow sport visitors. Within Queenstown, trends and overall guest nights have been consistently positive over the last 3 to 4 years. Projections point to increased levels of visitor spend both nationally and within the Queenstown region. Sea area visits, on the other hand, have been relatively static. 1.5 million sea area visits were recorded nationally in 2015. It's actually lower than the figures in 2009. This quite competitive environment necessitates the development of world-class alpine offerings that are cost-competitive and environmentally sustainable. And it's critical that developments are also seen as all-season, rather than just winter focus, to cater to growing demand for year-round alpine experiences. the likely predicted shortening of available ski days due to climate change will also focus greater attention on the need to provide alternative activities that can engage visitors throughout the year. The focus on high-yield markets and the growing emphasis on the Chinese independent traveller also sits well with the proposed gondola and the related development of the park station experience. There is considerable interest among travellers in soft environmental and adventure experiences, and the proposed mix of walks, agritourism, mountain biking, cultural and natural experiences fits well with this market profile. The gondola will also fit well with the anticipated increase in convention travel to Queenstown in the coming years. A lack of readily available primary research means that there can only be broad estimates made for the economic impacts associated with the gondola proposal. The construction cost of the gondola will be approximately $55 million New Zealand dollars, and this will be spent over an 18-month period. The construction phase will include around 20 to 25 staff or workers. Numerous downstream suppliers and subcontractors will also be involved. The ongoing operation of the gondola will require at least 10 full-time equivalent jobs, and from that we will see through a multiplier effect another 3 full-time equivalent jobs generated indirectly through the local economy. Further employment will be generated by the remarkable park station development, the need for service provided at the endpoint of the gondola and at the park station will obviously also have an impact on local employment and local household income. The gondola will generate a total of $1.25 million in direct local household income per year of operation. Expenditure on non-labour related items such as supplies and services in the local area is likely to be in the range of $400,000, that's including foot multiplier. Every 10,000 new snow sport visitors attracted to Queenstown in the marketplace by the presence of the gondola, i.e. those are visitors that would not have come to Queenstown without the gondola being part of their experience, would be estimated to generate approximately $7.5 million in the local economy in terms of income. For the far larger group that would likely travel to Queenstown regardless of the gondola, but would actually spend a little bit more time in Queenstown because of the gondola, we can argue that even an extra half day of local stay would generate approximately $1.7 million per 10,000 snow sport visitors. The focus on snow sport visitors there is that's obviously based on the research that we conducted around 10 years ago on the economic impact of snow sports areas in the country. For a very small percentage of visitors, it is likely that spend on the gondola will simply represent a reallocation of their budget from one local experience to another. This displacement effect is estimated to be relatively limited as there are no directly complementary products on offer in Queenstown. In fact, I think you could argue that the gondola would complement many of the existing products. The proposed gondola represents an environmentally efficient form of transportation that is also extremely safe. The likely reduction in traffic and parking congestion and traffic accidents has broader economic and society-wide benefits. The gondola also offers the opportunity to spread visitor impacts into shoulder seasons and to create a four-season resort approach to economic development. And that may well prove to be an effective economic strategy as we impact the global climate change development in the future. While it is difficult to present exact impact figures at this stage of the development, it is clear that the proposed gondola will generate significant economic benefits to the Queenstown area. It is estimated the impacts on visitor spend and arrivals in the state will be significant, with downstream benefits being felt by industry, local suppliers and the broader community.
Thank you. big problem.
Well, the only thing I'd clarify, Sarah, is what QPL is not considered on a rural vehicle or rural lifestyle zones or the Gibson character zone. So those notices, I understand that. Thank you.
This is a summary statement, and I address chapter 21 various issues there, chapter 22, 23 and 33. So first issue of chapter 21 is providing for farming activities and non-farming activities. So I consider that the chapter 21 zone purpose statement and the objectives and policies are too far weighted in the direction of enabling farming, and for example see the first sentence of the zone purpose. And indeed the whole purpose statement is about farming and other activities that are very much secondary. The first sentence reads, the purpose of the rural zone is to enable farming activities. So, as I say, it's too far weighted in that direction. And they should better provide for non-farming activities also, in my view. The economic and landscape evidence for this topic supports this. The objectives and policies should be modified so that they encourage and enable non-farming activities, subject to ensuring that their effects on the environment are managed. My redrafted objective 21.2.2 and its policies are an aggregated and reconstituted version of the notified objective 21.2.9 and 21.2.10. In fact, they're policies, sorry. Oh, no, sorry. Yeah, objective 21.2.9 and 21.2.10 and the suite of policies that go under them. They have the effect of enabling but regulating non-farming activities, including, for example, commercial recreation, rural living, and diversification of farming activities. My proposed policy 21.2.2.3 relates to rural living in the Mokopi Basin, again reflecting the economic and landscape evidence, and with further consideration I've modified that policy so that it reads, as stated there, that the new bold black underlined and the cross-outs are from the provision that I presented in the evidence in chief. I'll let you just read through that. And this proactive wording better reflects the similar proactive wording of all the other policies which implement objective 21.2.2. The amended wording also specifically recognises the existing rural living character of much of the Mokopi Basin. The implications of this new policy relate primarily to the cumulative effects of further rural living development in the basin. And I consider that an additional assessment matter, which I've termed 21.7.2.7d, specifically applicable to the Mokopi Basin, is necessary, and that is, as I've listed there, and the other changes are as per my evidence in chief. So the new assessment matter reads, in the Mokopi Basin rural landscape, development is consistent with or enhances the existing rural living character and amenity values of, and will not result in over the domestication of the locality. This reintroduces the term over-domestication, which originally came from the original WESI decisions, and the operative plans and the district-wide policy for cumulative effects of subdivision and development, and in various assessment matters relating to cumulative effects. Fundamentally, the issue is about allowing further rural living development, but only where consistent with existing character and amenity values. The second subtopic of Chapter 21 is providing for commercial recreation activities. Commercial activities and commercial recreational activities have different definitions and should both be recognised in the Table 1 Rule 21.4.15 as follows, and it's just inserting commercial recreation. into that rule. The activity status remains discretionary. Without this addition, commercial activities ancillary to a commercial recreation activity would be non-compliant, and this is not justified given the economic evidence about the importance of enabling a range of non-farming activities in the rural zone. The next topic is surface and water activities, and I support the objective with the addition, which I'll let you read through. And with this wording, the objective better recognises that the waterways are used and will continue to be used for a range of commercial and non-commercial recreation activities, ensures that the objective is appropriately balanced and that the waterways can be used appropriately as well as protected, maintained and enhanced, and provides better context for the policies which include promotion of water-based activities. I support the recognition of lake and river-based public passenger transport in the provisions. The possible ferry route from Queenstown, Franklin Arm and the Quarra River, connecting the various existing and future sediment areas, is a perfect example of an alternative transport connection to contribute to relieving road congestion. It can also facilitate access and enjoyment of the river and its margins. On ski areas, I propose some modifications to Objective 21.26 and its policies, including the addition of a new policy, 21.264, which I consider should be worded as follows. It's the same as in the evidence in chief, but I've changed the word associated to ancillary in relation to structures and facilities. The word ancillary limits the kinds of structures and facilities to those necessary for a passenger lift system, such as ticketing, toilets and shelter. And it better aligns with the additional clause G I've added into the definition of ski area activities over the page, which is buildings for or ancillary to the activities in A to F above. That's from my version. The definition also includes Mr. Barr's new clause in F above, and I consider that this definition overall is better than Mr. Barr's definition, because buildings that are necessary for the activities, such as those identified above as ticketing, toilet, and shelter, are explicitly provided for. In Rule 21.5, Table 3, I consider that the preamble should include the words and passenger lift systems along with farm buildings as the exemptions from the standards applying to structures and buildings. This would mean that passenger lift systems would be exempt from the standards of buildings. This is necessary because, for example, many pylons will almost certainly be higher than 8 metres in height. However, this is not to say that the effects of passenger lift systems should not be managed. Within ski area subzones, they are a controlled activity. And in paragraph 2.41 of my evidence in chief, I indicated that outside ski area subzones, the default status for passenger lift systems should be controlled and discretionary, restricted discretionary. Having reflected further, I consider that the status should be restricted discretionary because, given the potential effects, including ecological, landscape, and geotechnical, in the areas in question and the operational needs, the consent authority should have the power to refuse consent. And the following new rule, which I've seen 21.419A, would be necessary. So that's a new rule of activity status of restricted discretionary with discretion reserved to those matters and bullet points, which I'll give you a moment to read through. One matter I just commented on is that there are landscape assessment methods for the rural landscape classification and the outstanding natural landscapes and features, which with the intent of enabling passenger lift systems, I would think that my rule would override those in the same way that the ski area subzones are exempt from those landscape categorisation. Now, whether the appropriate words would go in the rule or whether they would go in the Chapter 6 rule, which provides for exemptions in various places, including secondary subzones, I'm not sure, but I would think the appropriate place is all in one, which is in the Chapter 6 rule, which is in the Chapter 6. Chapter 22, Rural Residential and Lifestyle Zones. I support Mr. Barr's additions to Table 2, Rule 2251, relating to the reflective values of natural materials and the colours of windows. These are necessary to avoid triggering additional consent requirements. In 22.432, regarding the location of buildings within the building platform site, the words visibility from public places should be deleted from the list of matters over which discretion is restricted. The visibility of an expansion to the building's gross floor area outside the building platform, subject to meeting other development controls, will not have adverse effects on the view from a public place, given the effects arising from the existence of the building and platform anyway. Now, briefly on Gibson Character Zone. To a large extent, my comments about the Gibson Character Zone are the same as those for the rural zone, including the need, in my view, for the effects of policy to more actively recognise activities other than viticulture that rely on the rural resources of the zone and managing the effects of those activities. This includes rural living, which I've added into policy 23218, so that it sits alongside commercial recreation and visitor accommodation as examples of activities that are complementary to the character and viability of the zone, again providing that their effects are matched. And that all of those activities, rural living, commercial recreation and visitor accommodation, are discretionary anyway in that zone. So this is providing just a level of policy recognition. Chapter 33, Indigenous Vegetation and Biodiversity. Now, further to my comments on scheme area subzones, I consider that the Chapter 33 purpose statement should be modified to recognise not only scheme area subzones, but also the potential for access to them, that is, by passenger assistance. This proposed plan does not directly incentivise the protection of areas of ecological value, but I consider that opportunities for proposals that can demonstrate a significant Indigenous biodiversity gain implemented as part of a development should at least be recognised in the Chapter 33 effects of policies. And I support adding the following or similar policies, and these are direct from my evidence to check. And they're effectively about protecting, maintaining, enhancing, and using development to achieve that. And in my evidence to check, I set out that in other areas, they directly incentivise protection of ecological values by allowing development right in return for that protection. This plan doesn't go that far, but I think it should go at least to be encouraging environmental protection as part of development. And indeed encouraging development that in turn protects and enhances Indigenous values. These are complemented by and will be given effect to by existing assessment method 21733B in Chapter 21, which relates to the positive effects of development, including the enhancement of Indigenous biodiversity values. And related to this is my suggested new policy 33243, which, as I said before, is encouraging. And also in this chapter I suggest modifications to policy 33223 to reflect that some land may not necessarily be farmland and that small-scale low-impact removal of Indigenous vegetation should not just be allowed for farming purposes but can be for other non-farming purposes also, including public access and recreation. And in objective 33.24 and policy 33.241, amendments so that the focus is on the adverse effects of vegetation clearance and for better consistency with the policies that do promote some limited removal of vegetation in some circumstances. And thank you.
Mr. Brown, please answer your question.
Thank you, Mr. Brown.
First question's a general one regarding the inclusion of the term non-farming activities. And just when I looked at that, I thought, well, farming's provided, and then thing is to allow, if you use the term non-farming, then that means anything that's not farming. Therefore, that might have the potential to be interpreted by some people quite widely. So I wondered whether you considered anything such as, does it require a definition in your view, or something of that nature?
Where I've used that term, or where I've talked about other activities that aren't farming, I've always tried to qualify it. For example, in the zone purpose, other activities that rely on rural resources. So it's non-farming but still needs to be rural, as opposed to just straight non-farming. And then going to my revised objective 21.2.2, that refers to which is a key objective for non-farming. It's a range of activities that rely on or benefit from a rural location are enabled, subject to being managed appropriately. And all through there is always referenced back to rural, a genuine link with rural resources, farming, recreation, horticulture. That's policy 21.2.2.2. So I would be not promoting to you a policy that says enable farming or non-farming without the qualification that it needs to be connected to rural resources.
Turning to 2.11, that paragraph there, the objective, you haven't recommended any changes to that, but in terms of good practice, is it appropriate? Is it good or appropriate to have what's effectively an activity status identified in an objective?
As in permitted?
Yeah.
Yes. I thought that was getting at generally, I agree with you, no, and this is an objective we leave activity status to the rules. Here, I think the objective, which is the council objective, is trying to list the sort of activities that are enabled, and the permitted word is used as a generic term for everything that it's trying to anticipate, rather than list them all.
Because in paragraph 9.1 you refer to the use of the RMA terminology, so I was just, if I was going to apply that into looking at this, permitted means permitted as if we're doing the plan, just whether there's any issues around that.
I agree with you. And again, I think it's the council simply just trying to not have a massive list. We're just trying to encompass things which are just plainly would be enabled in the zone without consent.
Turning to the next policy, second policy below that, 21212, when you've taken out the 100 hectares, in terms, which then, in terms of the policy, just leaves people interpret it that relying on larger land holdings is the requirement. What would you mean by larger?
I agree with your comment. How do we define that? Perhaps, I mean, there may be small land holdings that are still trying to be farmed or are farmed that you need a shed or a barn. So trying to restrict it, now that you've alerted me to that, I'm not sure what the purpose is. It's still rural, it's still trying to promote farming among other activities. But as long as the effects are managed, then I'm not seeing what the difference is.
So, potentially the word larger could be removed?
Yes, it could be, yeah.
And in there, because it does say that the effects are being managed for their effect on landscape values, so it identifies that. Turning over the next page, 213, the new objective 21.2.2. In terms of the adverse effects that are being managed, what are they being managed for? Brown, I should warn, I'm a pedant on this. I'm sure lots of people in the background are going to go on about these, but whenever you say something like managed, I always like it to say afterwards, what is the purpose that it's been managed for? Just managed on its own doesn't tell you why you're going about it.
Yes, I was leaving that to the policies.
Shouldn't the policies be implementing the objective, and the objective tells us the state, the end goal that we have in mind?
Yes, okay. It could be a long objective then, but we're looking at we're still endeavouring to retain ruralness. I guess rural character and amenity are still there. Ecological values are maintained, protected, enhanced, and are not or adverse effects on them are avoided, remedied, and mitigated. Those sorts of things.
Paragraph 217. So my version doesn't have page numbers on it, I've got it written as 12. And I realise in 218 that you've just modified it to make it simpler.
Yes.
But the objective there, reverse sensitivity effects are managed. But for what?
Yes.
What purpose is really what I was wanting assistance on.
Yes, well, we want to avoid remedy or mitigate conflicts between adjoining uses. That's the key.
Yeah. So is it minimise, reduce, so are those?
Well, minimise, reduce, I still prefer the avoided or remedied or mitigated. Like viticulture, you have a separation distance or you have some intervening landscaping between a residential activity and the actual viticulture, for example. So that's a way of avoiding and mitigating.
But if you just avoid remedy and mitigation in reality, that's your objective, then in reality you're asking for mitigation. So you may as well say minimise.
I might be responsible, but I think going back to the ARPA specific case, Judge Thompson, in about 2004, there's a lot of woodstone aggregates and quarries and all those, a lot of focus on the internalisation of the operator as well as reasonable expectations of those coming to the rural area want to expect, not complain about overserve. So what Mr. Brown and I discussed was how you capture the obligation of both parties. So you're not going to have a suite of objectives and policies that impose an obligation just on one party. That's why we're looking at avoid remedy or mitigating. And it's not until you look at the realities of the incompatibility that you can be reasonable about how much burden you place on either party. And so perhaps take some responsibility because I have a perspective where the private landowner rather the industry can only do so much and could operate and internalise to the best that they can as well. So I don't know how for the policy, that's why the avoid remedy or mitigate gives you a variety of options to manage the compatibility.
That's certainly a policy with it.
But what about the objective?
I think the objective, the problem with the objective, is my reading, when I've interrupted is that it focuses immediately on reversing stability effects, whereas what you've described is actually something a little bit different. You've described a sharing of responsibility to
it's a cause by you too, not
I just wonder if that's part of the problem with the objective has jumped too quickly to reversing stability effects and not dealt with the issue, which is sensitive activities locating in areas where effects might be adverse to those sensitive activities.
Or the amenity is the issue of starting point.
We do tend to move to the thing of incompatibility, sensitivities, co-location. The term you'll know, but I understand you saying that's the result. What's the cause, perhaps, or that's the outcome, what's the cause. So,
is it to reduce incompatibility between activities in rural areas? Is that really what has been sought?
I have the word manage in my mind, but I didn't want you.
Well, manage is how you reduce it.
Yes.
Is that what you're seeking, Mr. Brown? Is the incompatibility that you're aiming at dealing with?
Yes, it is. Bear in mind also that when I use the term manage, that's means avoid remedy mitigate, as I've expressed in the other the higher order hearing. And the manage is the current term being promoted by Mr. Barr as well. So I was figuring that whole the objective and the suite of policies were getting at reverse sensitivity. But if the end game is just making sure that incompatible activities are either separated or if they're going to be close to each other, at least the tension is mitigated or avoided, then incompatibility would be a good word to have in there.
turning to paragraph 222 about the assessment matters, just in, you've attached those in attachment B. How are the assessment matters related to the policies that they are derived from, I suppose, that's what the changes that you're suggesting in here, in terms of the assessment criteria, how are they related to the, do they match up with the policies?
In large part, yes. I mean, these are for activities in the rural landscape classification where a landscape assessment is required. So it's triggered by the various rules of procedure. And those rules are there because there are policies saying that the matters need to be managed in either a general way or a more direct way. But the assessment matters are there to then focus that assessment on things that the district plan wants to be thought through and considered, so that the decision maker has got a pretty good grounding of the proposal and its effects in order to make the decision.
Do the assessment matters, in your view, go wider than what the policies do?
Look, I haven't worked through that. That would be an exercise to work through and just exactly see where is the foundation for, you know, that particular assessment matter back in the policies. I could do that, but it's not an easy task.
I don't think I want you to do that. It'd give me a lot more comfort if it was done, but yeah, do I? Turning over the page to 2.24. My usual hobby horse here is just in terms of, again, that the use of the term manage, and whether protected, maintained or enhanced is an objective, but then when terms like recognised and provided for, when I look at an objective, if it's supposed to state a goal, then the recognition of something doesn't actually add anything. Recognise and provide for, in my experience, usually sits down in what might be a policy. So I was interested in what your view on formulating this objective in particular, and whether if they're two different things, should there be two different objectives potentially?
My preference is that they're all in one objective, because there's that they're they're so correlated.
So you don't think they become confused for a decision maker when you're looking at that? The objective is you've got to do two things here.
I prefer that the word while is still in there, so that we're doing one while we're doing the other. If it's just a bold objective that the surface of lakes and rivers and margins are protected, maintained or enhanced, for the reasons I've expressed later in the evidence, that's quite a high hurdle. Mm. And for example, a jetty or a public transport proposal, a planner assessing it, the council might not think that it's doing anything like protecting, maintaining or enhancing the surface or the margin. So it's like a section 5 provision. You're doing this while you're doing that. So I prefer it that way. But back to your point about recognising and providing for, that could be, the wording of that could be recognised, it could be modified so that the mere fact that we're stating it means that we're recognising it. But the key here is that we want to be providing for it, but we want to make sure that it's not going to be adversely affecting the values in question, or that we can remedy or mitigate any adverse effects.
I'll ask some questions now, so we may have all the planning ones at one hit. In your summary, paragraph 4, you set out your proposed policy 21 and 223, which is about rural building development in the Waitakere Basin. I'm just wondering how, and this applies in the rural zone, doesn't it, this policy?
Yes, it's a rural zone policy.
Yes. I'm just wondering how that policy on rural living relates to the rural living zones of rural residential and rural lifestyle that are also provided in the Waitakere Basin. So is there some relationship with this policy in those?
No. No, this is for the rural zone, chapter 21. So this is about some provision for rural living in the areas that are not in the rural living zones, where rural living is the purpose of those zones, and the provisions are developed accordingly. Here the purpose is not just for rural living, it's for a variety of other things as well. Farming, other activities, commercial recreation, as has been talked about by other witnesses. So this is a provision for rural living, but it's not, it's a part of what could happen in the rural zone, but it's not the purpose of the rural zone.
You don't see any potential future confusion about having such a policy for rural living within the same area that actually zones also, which also have policies dealing with landscape character and amenity values adjoining or nearby to the sites that the decision maker may be trying to apply this policy.
No. I think because the through the formulation of this plan in Section 32, it's been determined that the rural residential and rural lifestyle zones can accommodate that activity, and that that is their primary purpose, subject to some level of landscape protection. Whereas in the rural zone, that's not the case. That hasn't been determined that that is, and that it relies then on a case-by-case basis through a discretionary proposal to determine whether the rural life, the rural living proposal can be accepted or not. So in other words, the bar here is a lot higher than the bar in the defined zones.
It's over in paragraph 16 in the summary, and this is you refer here to the height standards applying. Do those standards actually apply to discretionary activities? There's two parts to the question. It's A, what does the plan say, and what is the general resource management approach?
That's an interesting question.
That's why I asked for this.
Yes. of course, if I just look at farm buildings as an example,
the native standards as to
yes.
The dimensions of location, etc.
Then in table 3, the following standards apply to structural buildings except farm buildings.
Farm buildings over the page, perhaps over 10 metres.
Mr. Brown, if you but there's an interesting part of the provisions which I'm not sure if they're rules or what, 313.3. I wonder if that was just us.
The orthodox thinking appears to me, I'm not saying that that's the correct thinking, you don't need a standard, you default to discretionary activity status, and then that standard applies to the assessment of discretionary activity because it's the trigger for your activity status. Now, I'm not saying that is how the plan works when you read it, but that's the approach that you've understood. So, I know that's helpful, but that's...
Does that apply to restricted discretionary activities as well? Or just fully discretionary?
You can't default to triggers.
Well, it would be, if you had a list of restricted discretionary activity and you also had some standards for structures, say here, you were breaching one of those standards, then you would require restricted discretionary activity for the activity itself and require restricted discretionary activity for the breach of that standard, if it's a site standard under the operative plan. So I was
figuring out the operative plan, but I'm just thinking outside of the operative.
Mm-hmm.
Which was very particular about all those standards. If you say something is restricted to discretionary activity,
to violate the law, you have to restrict those standards and state them clearly in the plan. You can't cast any white that isn't restricted.
Mm-hmm.
You're restricted to discretion.
Mm.
So you don't understand the issue. So if you're restricted to discretion, then you expect
there to
be a list of matters to which your discretion is restricted.
And the reason I pointed this around to 21.3 3.3 is it seems to say that permitted activities must comply with the standards. But I can't find anything else that says any other activity status needs to comply with the standards.
Okay, in terms of 21.336, the control and restrictive discretion is the council shall restrict the exercise of its discretion in the manner that is suitable. I am assuming until now that the same process would apply. That the example I gave before,
yes.
RD consent for that, RD consent for that, will be in the same package. However,
restricted discretion rate with that 8 meter height limit. I think the question is, well then, are you restricted to height?
I think just a young legal point of view, you might want to look at 21.331 as well. It's called clarification, but I wonder if it's actually a rule.
Although 21.332 says that we're an exception that must comply with the standard, that isn't restricted to just permitted activities.
So I don't know if we're going to answer this satisfactorily on the fly, but I wonder if we might have time to think about that and if we can usually comment.
I'd be wrong, please. Mr. Todd, if you're able to help too, when you have your opportunity to speak. it seems to me that it's a little bit ambiguous at the moment, slightly, but that's why I asked Mr. Brown if he could assist. And as well, yes, I'd like to look at that as well.
On the face of it, I think 21.332 will tell me that if I don't comply with the standard, then I would need to go through the non-compliance status column. And that's because that's not confined to just permitted, that would kick in, I think.
Doesn't that just direct you to the column on the right-hand side where it tells you what the activity status is? So not complying it, and then...
Where do you go? Is that the question, sort of, I understand it, then you get there, where you go then? Where is the restrictive list, or are we looking at the full set of pricing?
I'm a bit old-fashioned, but I do remember the conditional use didn't have to comply with the standards.
I've heard about that, but I don't know.
There is an argument that discretionary activities could be the same, because if you have full discretion, then you have full discretion on all aspects of the activity. If you have a restricted discretion, the discretion is restricted to only those elements that are listed, and if the elements that are listed don't say it's limited to 8 metres of height, I would have thought the discretion is not limited in that area. It's not restricted. You can't exercise any discretion in respect of that issue. It's not possible.
No, I understand. I think the preference would be to have that discretion restricted and intensive, and you can clearly say that it's not limited.
Okay.
Apologies for being so unhelpful.
No, that is okay.
Hey, Mr. Brown, I've just got a couple of questions in relation to the summary. On page 3 at the top, where you suggested some additions to Objective 21.2.12, the way that objective might be interpreted, would you see that favouring existing users of that resource for those purposes, or someone who's looking to apply the consent to become a recreational, commercial, recreational or public transport activity? And I'll tell you the reason why I'm asking it is that we've got quite a specific submission from Real Journeys in relation to TSS Earns Law, and they're concerned about some quite specific operational requirements on that Earns Law. And they gave an example of, for example, a windsurfing activities getting consent from the Queenstown Bay and the effect that that could have on the safe operation of the import. So the way it's written and the way that I read it at the moment, it's looking like it's protecting existing uses rather than providing for someone who might look to apply to become a new user. Is that how you read it?
No, I was intending that it be for present and any future that might come along.
Yes.
Not weighted in favour of either of those, but just hopefully, I was reading it as being entirely neutral.
Okay. Because that's with the sort of present tense, they utilise those resources.
I'm not reading it that way. I'm thinking that the activities that utilise would include the applicant for any particular proposal that's intending to do that. So, so if I'm a new operator, a public transport activity, for example, I want to utilise those resources as well. And as long as my effects are managed, then that's what I'm being assessed under. So no, I'm not seeing it as being a line in the sand for now. The futures need to be assessed somehow differently.
Thank you. And just one more question on page 5, paragraph 18. You're talking about the reflective values of natural materials. We've had some debate around this. Clearly, if you've got a colour finish, a painted material, you might go to a paint chart and find out what the resin tells us the light reflectance value is. In your experience in this district, do you see any difficulty with assessing the reflectance value of a natural material that might have some gradation in colours?
I was kind of just thinking about stone and unpainted timber and things like that, which are very common materials here. And I'm presuming that the reflective values of those can be determined. As opposed to you know, resin colours and things like that,
yes.
Which are probably quite easily determined versus some, you know, a schist wall.
Yes.
Look, I'm just not sure, but we had some submissions on that, and I read Mr. Barr's. I'm not sure if we've got right in front of me, but I thought that he had taken care of that particular issue by effectively was an exclusion of those materials from needing to go through reflectance value, or rather needing an additional consent. If you're using natural materials in your house, do you actually need a consent under that reflective value standard? That's as I read what Mr. Barr had written, and I thought that would deal with the concern that I had.
And we've had another suggestion that we could just exclude schist, for example.
Right, or a specific list of exclusions that might work for.
Yes. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Brown.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, sir. Apologies for the poor explanation of time, but
we can't guarantee how long it will take. Thank you. I apologise for the delay, but I can assure you that people will go into our lunch time at this.
No problem.
I'm pleased to see that Crete has been with you.
Sorry?
I'm pleased to see that Crete has been with you.
Yes.
Thank you.
Commissioners, these brief submissions are made in support of submissions and where applicable further submissions that have been filed in respect of the proposals that are planned by the parties that I note thereafter, noting that I am one of those parties in personal capacity. A number of the submitters either seek rezoning of all or parts of their property or oppose the rezoning of neighbouring property. Other submitters generally support the proposed district plan provisions or seek minor changes to specific plan provisions as notified. In terms of those that seek or oppose rezoning, substantive submissions and evidence in support of their submissions will be given at the time of the hearings to the MAT that form part of the proposed district plan. The parties that I represent own or have an interest in a range of rural zoned land throughout the district, from probably the largest in economic terms farming operation in the district, which is also the only dairy farm, to an 8,000 square metre rural living allotment in the Wanganui Basin that I personally live on. Before turning to the specifics of the individual submissions, can I confirm that I've had the benefit of reading the majority of the legal submissions and briefs of evidence that have been presented to this hearing screen. I've also tried to listen to the recordings of the hearings, although unfortunately this is sometimes proven to be difficult and frustrating given the quality of the recordings and the difficulty in hearing questions from panel members and answers given by submitters, counsel or witnesses. I do not intend to repeat the majority of the matters you have already heard and will hear this afternoon. Can I say, however, that I believe that in terms of the issues relating to the provisions or lack thereof contained or which should be contained in the proposed district plan for rural living, I thought the legal submissions of Warren Goldsmith and Rosie Hill were extremely well developed and highly relevant in terms of the matters you require to consider. The evidence in support of such submissions as they relate to the predominance given to farming activities and the lack of recognition and provisions for rural living, especially as it relates to the Wanganui Basin, was also accurate in my view and highly relevant.
Mr. Todd, it might be a good at that point in your submission to ask you, did you hear my discussion with Mr. Young about the discussion we had yesterday with Mr. Goldsmith regarding...
Yes, and Mr. Goldsmith had also given me writing instructions, as it were, in respect of that matter as well.
Yes.
And he had alerted me to it, and we discussed it. And I think it's a very relevant very pertinent that this panel should direct the council to go away and have a proper look at what's actually occurring. This is right, and these submissions were prepared before I knew about those comments. I had the benefit of reading Mr. Goldsmith's submission because he sent it to me. As far as what I understand you discussed with him yesterday, that you referred to Mr. Young this morning, it's my view that this is the time when that exercise was undertaken. A number of people who lay people in the district have asked me what these hearings were all about, and I said, and one of the responses I've given in the past is that if everybody got what they wanted, there'd be very little grass left in the Wanganui Basin.
Yes, until last night after the hearings, Commissioners St. Clair and Coombs hadn't been aware of the map that's available on the council website that shows the range of pieces of land that are subject to zone change requests.
Yes.
They understood then why I suggested the Wanganui Basin needs a...
Well, I haven't seen it either, but I can only imagine having a general knowledge of what is being sought by way of submission on this district plan. And to a certain extent, I think that's understandable, that the opportunity only arises, once every 20 years, this is the first time in the last 20 years I was by way of private plan changes. And one can understand why people take that opportunity to seek something for their property. I think it's also possibly relevant in the sense that I'm starting to be aware of a
groundswell of opinion of people who probably haven't taken part in these proceedings for whatever reason. And those reasons vary. But there is a general concern, should I say, about what is the tipping point, particularly in the rural area of the district.
I am aware of that from some of the resource consent hearings that I've sat on. I found the standing point of this.
Now, with respect to the council and the staff who have drafted the proposed district plan and the staff expert witnesses and legal advisors who have written the and commented on the section 42 reports given evidence or legal submissions in respect to the council positions, in my view there needed to be a major reality check in terms of exactly what is occurring today within the Walkesbury Basin. I've lived in this district for 35 years, including for a large part in the rural area. I've also acted during that period for a wide range of Walkesbury Basin residents and other entities who have had some involvement in the same. I calculate that there is now less than 10 real pastoral farmers left in the Walkesbury Basin who run what might be described as real farms and who would have the infrastructure one would expect to be associated with a pastoral farm, such as wool sheds, milking sheds, etc. There are no milking sheds. And I was scratching to get beyond 7 wool sheds that I'm aware of that exist in the Walkesbury Basin. From my own perspective, I live on Slope Hill Road West. In terms of all the properties along that road, which I would estimate would comprise some 350 hectares, there is only one landowner who happens to be a very busy local doctor who grazes any livestock, and one other property where a local policeman grazes a few sheep. Two other owners have horses. Now that of that 350 hectares, I would estimate that there'd be about 25 owners, and those properties would range from probably close to 40 hectares down to the lot that I'm on, being 8,000 square metres. So that gives you an idea of what's going on in that immediate enclave. Yes, I agree we'll often see properties throughout the basin where sheep are being grazed, but in my experience and knowledge that is often simply for the purposes of keeping the grass mown on blocks of land that are otherwise too large to maintain by the rural living owner who normally does not maintain the equipment such as tractors and mowers capable of mowing larger areas. We won't talk about that, I mean blocks of land over that otherwise have the problem that people have seen as a normal curtilage around the house. For example, on our property, 8,000 square metres, it's relatively easy to maintain. You go to a block of land that might be 2 or 3 hectares, that's a totally different proposition. The majority of those are not maintained in terms of the curtilage. And there's an entry curtilage as well. In summary, and I and those that I represent who have an interest in provisions relating to rural living generally support the legal submissions and evidence which has been given, seeking greater recognition of the rural living already occurring, and provisions for objective policy rules and assessment matters that provide the opportunity for such inappropriate locations in the future. What is important is that the plan provisions recognising such must be at a... But they must be in the correct location and make provision for avoiding, remedying, mitigating the adverse effects of such, and most importantly, do not result in the over-domestication of what I would suggest is really an amenity rather than a rural landscape. And I've been saying for some years that the Walkesbury Basin is really an amenity landscape, it's not a rural landscape anymore. There are rural activities being undertaken in that landscape, but that is only just one of a number of activities. Now, turning to the specific submissions, I represent what they sought in terms of their submissions. Mr. Cooper, he owns approximately 2,600 hectares of rural zone land on the Harwea Flats, bordered by the Harwea River to the west, Clutha River to the south, Cane Road to the east, and Campbell Road to the north. He also has an interest in other rural land at Mount Barker and Mount Clutha, which is used to support his main farm. The Harwea Flat property has and continues to be developed as a dairy farm known as Denham Dairy Farm, which eventually will have 6 to 8 milking sheds and will run about 4,500 dairy cows. Currently there are 3 milking stations and another one being built this year, in excess of 2,500 cows are milked. Up to 20 staff are employed on the property, and at times that's increased in the season
budgetary haymaking and those are previous subsidies. And that doesn't include independent contractors to the property. Those would start before the criteria period.
The overall farming operation would be the most highly farmed farming operation in the district, with the land components alone being purchased 5 years ago before any development occurred for an excess of $30 million. So you can imagine what cost of or what the value of that property currently is. This recuperation has some minor issues with the provisions of the proposed district plan. That's not to say that at times you've been highly frustrated by the cost and time incurred in obtaining consent for infrastructure such as pivots, milking sheds and housing for staff. Notwithstanding farming, which obviously includes dairy farming, is a permitted activity as well as described as a rural zone within which the farm is located. This third previous specific submissions as it relates to the chapter being considered by you relates to the following. First, there's a rule 21.5.5, the requirement to have all vehicle and holding tanks and treatment and storage ponds set back at least 300 metres from any road or adjoining property. Normally such facilities are located in close proximity to the milking shed itself, and given the need for the milking shed for access to road and transporting milk, it is often impractical to have these located a significant distance back from the adjoining road, that's the milking shed itself. Indeed, one, and in fact, it was the first dairy shed that was developed by Coopers, and you may recall the users to the Commission of Engines and Commissioner Wharton, that there was some concern about dairy in the Harwell area, flat area at that time, and the development of this property. Well, the first dairy shed and associated effluent holding tanks and treatment and storage ponds on the Cooper property is located immediately adjacent to Campbell and Buffield Roads. My client's not aware of any complaint that's ever been made, notwithstanding the scrutiny that that property has come under. Not aware of any complaint that's been made with respect to issues arising from the effluent storage treatment. The second issue is designation D18V, and the list contained in Rule 3371 and the definition of clearance and vegetation the same relates to significant natural areas of indigenous vegetation. And indeed, this matter, the issue of the designation itself, will come up again during the mapping hearings of the detailed submissions. This part of the submission relates to the identification of a significant natural area of indigenous vegetation on the Cooper's property. The accuracy of the list of plants, including the list of 3371, to the extent they might be threatened, and the inclusion of irrigation means clearance of indigenous vegetation. Cooper property has been extensively developed with pivot irrigation over the last 5 years. The area identified in the designation containing some significant indigenous vegetation is actually one of the areas covered by the irrigation, the existing irrigation pivot. That area will be the subject of more detailed submission at the time the hearing commences. In the meantime, in the interim, Mr. Cooper relies on submission and evidence presented to you in support submission by Jury Bell Investments, what in fact he's contributing to the cost of that evidence that was presented to you, and Federated Farmers in terms of inclusion of irrigation as a means of clearance of indigenous vegetation. My personal submission for my trust and my wife, these submissions and further submissions filed on behalf of myself, which I'm trustee of my trust, my wife through the proprietors of 122 Swagger Road West. The property is a rural living property, some 8,000 square metres, created in the early 1990s from rules that existed at that time allowing creation of rural living lots of 8,000 square metres and 20 hectares based on the size of the current landowner. The subdivision of which our property forms part was a subdivision of land from the Stuart Family Trust property, which I understand you've heard about in earlier comments as beginning to. The submissions and further submissions primarily support the position of the zoning boundaries east and above Lower Shot Over Road, and in particular the proposed boundary of the rural lifestyle or the general zone. This is above the area known as the triangle on Lower Shot Over Road. In particular, the further submissions opposed submissions on behalf of a number of neighbouring property owners to move the boundary further up the slopes of Slope Hill to enable those properties to be rezoned for rural lifestyle. The primary concern of the Trust and Mrs. Todd is that if such submissions seeking rezoning are allowed, this would result in an over-domestication of that landscape. The Trust and Mrs. Todd should make it clear they do not oppose neighbouring properties being developed for rural development. In fact, we support actively supported some. Indeed, the majority of the properties now sought to be rezoned have already been subdivided and developed for such use, but simply the intensity of such which would be allowed by the rezoning now sought as well as we can see. Mr. and Mrs. Nelson, it's a very simple submission. Theirs is a brick layer. The rest of the plot of land is located on Merton Road in the Washington Basin. Their land is included in the land proposed to be zoned rural lifestyle. That's a new rural lifestyle zone that the council promoted for that area. And the submitters support such rezoning. They, however, also support the deletion of the rules for such zoning that would seek to impose an average lot size of 2 hectares. The submitters support and adopt the submission's evidence you've already heard and seek the deletion of such rule. Their primary position is that if the land is rezoned for rural limited, the non-compliant status of subdivision below 2 hectares is too high a bar to overcome to justify an appropriate case of subdivision to where appropriate. Subdivision for a smaller area which might otherwise be justified. Tri-Land Industries Limited, it owns a property on the Wanaka, between the Wanaka Glenview Bay Road and Lake Wanaka, upon which they own and operate the Protegea Lodge. There is an airstrip located on the property that's been located for many years, and partly on the neighbour's property known as the Ruby Island Airstrip. It's never been formally consented. An application for consent to formalise that easement is currently being finalised with the involvement of the council next month. Tri-Lane has some issues with the rules for informing airports as originally notified, but a submission that generally be satisfied by the amendments now proposed by council staff and the city to be corrected.
I take it, Mr. Todd, that's a fixed wing.
Yes, yes it is.
Yes, right.
But I should say that consents are also held by the lodge in terms of helicopter operations. So it's both.
On the same strip?
No, no, it's not. The land, if you can imagine if you're driving out towards Glenview Bay from Wanaka, the land dips into a sort of valley in which the strip is located.
Mm.
The land then rises and goes over into a terrace above Lake Wanaka itself.
And they're okay with that lip.
Yeah. And so the lodge is on the lake side of the ridge, of the hill, sorry, and the airstrip is on the other side.
The reason I ask that is that Mr. Campbell, who is a...
Charging Campbell.
Yes.
Yes.
Quite instructive. He provided a map for us of airstrips that he knew of in the district.
Ah, right.
And I think he has marked this one on here. I should be able to assist you. I think put across beside the one that I think we're talking about.
Yes. May not be. I'm just trying to look where the road is at. No, maybe not, because if what I'm thinking is the road, maybe on the lower side of the road.
He may not have got precisely the right position. I don't think it's possible.
I don't think it would be possible on the other side.
No.
So, and indeed, the upper side is the property owned by the Norman Trust, and my client's property, and the other land on which the Ruby Island strip is located, was once part of what is the head property, the Norman Trust Farm. And so it would be logical they would have had two.
Yes.
This
and
I doubt this property on the top side would have allowed.
Yes, I don't think so. Mm-hmm. Yes, thank you.
In terms of carbon, that cylinder is the registered provider of wiring station, which in part surrounds the Glenview Township on its northern and eastern boundaries. Part of the station is proposed to be zoned rural lifestyle. In respect of such rezoning, the submitted primary submission proposes some corrections and seeks adoption of some objectives and policies of land related to such rezoning. The further submission opposes any relaxation in the proposed objectives, policies, rules and assessment matters as it relates to the activity of mining in a rural general zone. I think you've heard some submissions and evidence in support of this submission
by a company known as Tungsten Mining. My clients is the further submitter in opposition to that.
Right.
Tungsten Mining is wanting to undertake mining activities in and around the world. And my client is ardently opposed to the activity of mining and believes that such activity should be subject to stringent controls as proposed in the note by proposed three plans. So it supports those submissions.
Hogan Gully Farm, it's the owner of land bordered by State Highway 6, Maxnell Road, Hogan Gully Road at the Bend of the Special Zone. It has sought the rezoning of this land and modification of proposals from plan provisions to enable more diverse non-farming uses of this land in particular, to enable it to be developed and used as a golf course with associated facilities, and as part zone, and to be part zone, and to be part zone rural residential. The submission is supported by a detailed Section 32 analysis that supports such submission as was filed in conjunction with the original submission seeking those changes. The submission gives detailed reasons for the changes sought. Mr. Brown has given evidence on behalf of Hogan Gully in Chapter 6 and will present further evidence in support of the submission. I noted later today that's what he was given this morning. Hogan Gully supports and adopts the submissions and other evidence that has or will be presented to you that seeks recognition of the existing enhancement of rural, the existing development, sorry, rural development that has already occurred in the Waterloo Basin, and amendments to the proposed district plan that will enable such in the future, provided the objective policies and rules and assessment matters are met, and the specific location for such is appropriate. Hogan Gully opposes certain submissions as noted in its further submissions that seek to oppose or propose rezoning. Those maps will be heard at the time of these submissions on the maps. Now, Morden Ferry Limited is the owner of land located on Morden Ferry Road in the Waterloo Basin. It was formerly owned by the Hamiltons and is immediately adjacent to the land owned by Barn Hill, and again, I understand you've heard from Bums
several times.
And the submission seeks the rezoning of part of the Warm Ferry Road and the Barn Hill Road for rural and rural residential. The submission is again supported by detailed Section 32 analysis, which has been filed with the Council as part of the primary submission. The purpose of the hearing on Chapter 22. This submitter seeks the inclusion of an additional setback rule and that subdivision of the rural residential rural business zone should be a controlled activity rather than discretionary activity for the detailed reasons in the submission. That submitter will provide evidence in support of the submission of the rezoning at the time of the hearings and proposed to plan maps, but as with other submitters, it supports and adopts the submissions here and presented to you today to seek great recognition of the existing environment and development of the rural regional zone. The seek to change the proposed strict plan provisions that will enable further development for tourism as well as other opportunities and appropriate vacations for the rural zone in the future. Can I just add to those submissions two matters that have raised this morning? Commissioner Coombs asked one of the ones, I can't recall who it was, has there been changes, I think I picked up the question properly, has there been changes in the types of recreational activities that have been undertaken in the district over the last number of years, and clearly it's my submission that there has been and continues to be changes. In my time in Queenstown, some of those changes have included in the first year I was here in 1981, the first bungee jump off Carver and Bridge, and there's been subsequent developments for bungee supply, canyoning, all that occurred during that period. We've seen a surge in golf tourism with the development of Millbrook, Jazz Point, the hills, and substantial improvement to golf courses such as Golden Heights and Franklin. Golden Heights and Arizona. Well, indeed, Franklin's also undergone some improvement. There has been developments in the ski industry, such as snowboarding, in that period of time, which has significantly changed the face of snow sports in the district, and also different types of snow sports that have occurred. Half pipes have been developed to international standards on three of the ski fields in the area.
And so we're seeing, and then of course we're seeing the advent of the huge development supported by government and trails trusts, the trails development district. And the interesting thing in regards to that is the immediate access that quite significant urban areas have to that trails network, particularly I'm talking of both the Queen and the Queenstown, Brampton, Lake Hazel State, Shire Park scenario, but also on. You've got immediate access. You don't necessarily have the linkage of shared and monitoring that we have in Queenstown, but the urban areas have immediate access to those recreation areas, which have only been in the rural areas. We've also seen an advent or increase in the amount of water-based activities in that 30-year period. I was sitting here this morning looking out at something, jumping in and out of the water out there, which 30 years ago would have been crazy. So all of these things, and I'm just touching the tip of the iceberg in terms of how recreation and tourism activities have changed the face of what's going on in the Mokotoku Basin. We ourselves live on Slope Road West, which is part of the Trails Network. It's one of the few parts of the Trails Network in the Mokotoku Basin, which is on good legal growth. Some of those useful vehicles, and that causes some interest to grant, especially because it's quite a steep descending road and people get to the top of it. Has had a hard slog going up, 10 degree wheel going down,
and it's a corner halfway down.
Yeah. So, and we've seen the huge amount of increased use of that trail. And Trails Trust may have appeared to be at some stage in future figures, but a pretty staggering amount of use of these trails in the district. So, and people, it's not just people who live in the district that are coming to use those facilities. I'm aware of Australian clients who every year take seasons pass on the downhill mountain bike track on the skyline across Block 2. And they come for a weekend to simply ride the bike on that trail. And they bring the fly in for the bike, ride the trail and go out again. That's what they do. And that's the only purpose, the only reason they come to this is to do that. So the play that the recreational side of the tourism development in the rural area is dramatic. The other issue in relation to your questions that you just put to Mr. Young, I'm not sure if I understood the question properly, but I'm more than happy to try and answer it. But as I understand it, the situation is relatively clear that if you breach standards, then you look to the plan for guidance to what activity status you then are considered under in terms of that application. Now, if, for example, in a restricted discretionary activity, the only breach was the pipeline that pushed it into a restricted discretionary activity, it would be my submission to you that in such case, the only issue that you applied for the social discretion on would be in respect to the height. Whereas if you were otherwise fully complying, but you breached a site standard, which meant that the activity then became a discretionary activity, then it becomes fully discretionary. So for example, if
that's the operative plan.
That's the operative plan, but I understand that my view here, and I'm now having pointed out that it's incorrect, it's the same sort of situation.
Well, my question referred to really is where in the table of activities it states,
sorry, can you just put this in the table?
Oh, well, yeah, sorry, at 21, table 1, starting at 21.4.1. If we go down
page 21.10.
I'm just trying to find take go across the page, 21.4.15, and we have commercial activities and ancillary to them located on the same side as recreational activities.
Yes.
Are discretionary.
Yes.
Do those activities need to comply with the standards, such as heights? That was my question. It is already defined as discretionary.
Well, I guess that would depend if the non-compliance of the issue.
If it pushed it into discretionary.
Well, it is discretionary.
Yeah, sorry, it is discretionary. If it didn't comply with the heights
and the breach resulted in it becoming a site standard, then it's still discretionary.
Mm.
If the breach resulted in becoming non-compliant, then it becomes non-compliant.
Yeah,
you would still,
sorry, I'm still not convinced that the plan says that you have to apply the standards to discretionary activities.
Well, if you read the plan,
there may be a lacuna in the plan.
Well, if you read the plan as a whole, surely that must be the case, because you're required to read that rule in that table in the rural activities. And then, for example,
but if you go back to 21.8. That's two pages.
Yes.
And you'll see at the very bottom there, 21.331.
21.3.3 there. At the very bottom.
21.331.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
A permitted activity has to comply with all the standards.
Yes.
But that's all it says.
Well, I think it's saying that because it doesn't say it otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
And so my view is that, for example, the example that you gave, we go back to the example we were talking about, which I think was on page 2111, which was 21.4.15. Commercial activities in story 2 are located on the same site as recreational activities. It's fully discretionary.
Mm.
Now, for example, if there was a zone standard which was breached in respect of the same activity, then the whole activity becomes non-compliant activity. So I think the reason for the statement that you've alerted me to at 21.3.3.1 is that's just telling people that for it to become a permitted activity you comply with everything, because otherwise that's not obvious from the plan.
At the top of table 2 it says the following general standards apply to everything in tables 1 to 10. So everything in table 1 applies to that, so if you didn't meet one of those,
yeah.
Step back from buildings from...
Correct.
Step back from roads, if that's restricted discretionary,
yes.
Then you'd still remain discretionary?
Yes.
Yeah. Because the highest standard for the activity is discretionary.
Yeah. That's my answer. Mr. Young, the committee's been reformed and he had pointed out to me on page 21.9, and I must have got excited about it, ripped his page. And 21.9, clause 21.3.3.6, says for controlled and restricted discretionary activities, the council shall restrict the exercise of its discretion to the matters listed in a seventh rule. But I think it should read, or Mr. Young thinks it should read, I should say, listed in table 1.
To be clear, there are some issues for the rules that we're not sure about.
Right, I'm not sure there are. But we're all thinking that.
Mm.
So hopefully that's helped.
Okay, thank you.
Do you have any further questions, please?
Just in relation to your own property, you mentioned 8,000 square metres is relatively easy to manage, perhaps 2 to 3 hectares is a different story.
Yes.
We've heard some evidence from various people about what size is the right size for an average or a minimum lot in the rural lifestyle area. What would be your view about the sweet spot being?
I think that my concern about, and the shared concern that my trust and my wife have, is that you better to deal with these rather than having a zoning. I was concerned about comment that was contained, I think it was Mr. Wells' evidence, that 65 metres might be an adequate setback. That 65 metres might be an acceptable setback. I don't think you can say that in every particular case, but he was also saying that you can screen development by boundary planting. Well, if you look at our particular property, the greatest amenity that we have is the views that we have from an elevated position back down into the valley itself, because the top of Swank Hill is quite high up there. Notwithstanding that it's on a terrace, so it's a flat, it's not on a slope at all. But we're looking from our property, we're looking down. Now, if the property next door was subdivided down to 1 hectare rezoned rural living, subdivided down to 1 hectare. The only way to screen that development from our property would be to plant boundaries. And to plant boundaries, you lose the very amenity which attracted the property in the first place. So what I'm talking about, roundabout way, what I'm trying to say is, I don't think there is a utility. That's why the discretionary regime, to be fair, has worked relatively well, because in some circumstances you can have houses closer together and clustering. In other circumstances that doesn't work. And the best example, I think, of clustering in the district is in the Triangle, which was the Palmer cluster, because it's on flat land. And so you're looking up for your views, you're not looking across. And so you can landscape it and have houses in relatively close density in that situation, where you can't have that on other sides.
So I guess it's the effect of the topography on what you can see out of your property.
Yes.
I'm also interested in what size parcel of land is manageable.
Oh, manageable. Sorry, promise.
Obviously, yeah. Got a day job.
Yeah. Well, to give you an idea, and I'm not allowed on right on now because I'm not very good at that stuff. That's the last time I was given a drill that was taken off me very quickly because I was hanging up my degree and I managed to, I thought, gee, what are these metal fibers that I've laid out drilled into the back of the electrical so my wife does the mowing, but I can tell you that she tells me it takes her 90 minutes on a ride on mowing. And so what I'm saying to you, if you look around, the majority of properties that are a little bit bigger than our property tend to have a maintained curtilage, and then they'll tend to have paddocks which are either not maintained at all, cut, mown by a couple of sheep that somebody borrows off somebody, or a horse that the kids ride, or when it gets a bit bigger, like my immediate neighbours, they have contractors that come in and actually cut a property a couple of times a year for a payment. And so, some people have green fingers, there are some areas that have got developed blocks in the area, which are bigger than 8,000 square metres or a hectare. But generally, I think once you get over 1 or 2 hectares, I would say one, then most people are not maintaining the whole block.
Yep. Okay.
As in a curtilage arrangement.
Yes. Yep. Okay. And your paragraph 23 is in relation to
23?
Yes. Mr. Cooper's property.
Thanks.
You're identified a designation E18B containing some significant indigenous vegetation. It's actually within one of the areas covered by an irrigation pivot.
Yeah.
Is that an ETNA?
Or is
it
that you could be SNA, not designated.
Not
designated. Sorry, I'm sorry.
Yes,
SNA.
Okay.
But the SNAs are there by right designation or.
Yeah.
Or not by requirement authority.
Those are fine, but they're not there by way of notice of requirement.
No, I'm
not.
Correct.
That's
fine. Yes,
yes. And do you know anything about how that area was assessed for it?
Yes, I was there. I was there originally the day of what they written, and that was a number of years ago when it was first identified. Because I was asked to be on the property with the council officers at the time. Now, at that stage, it wasn't covered by cover, but it had been planned to, and the council were made aware of that. But I can tell you that those officers were on their hands and knees looking for the significant indigenous vegetation, which is now the subject of the SNA.
Thank you.
Following
on from that, does that make it any less significant?
No, sorry, I'm not saying it, but it does call for actual difficulties, which I think somebody gave it, that was given in support of the government made the same point, that sometimes it's very difficult. These rules that are there are very difficult for people to understand. We had that situation.
Yeah, I've gone through that quite a lot. Good examples of if we were to go back now and reassess that area, that, how much of an impact that irrigation may have had.
That's right, it would be a very good one, actually. Yeah. Can I also say that immediately adjoining the area, is a dock reserve on the top of the Kids River, and the same plants are in that dock reserve, which of course is not subject to grazing. And I should also say that the Cooper property already has a significant QE2 trust reserve protection part of the property, which does allow grazing, but has not been grazed, but as part of the management regime. And the Coopers themselves, as is known to the council, have a proposal to significantly enhance the area to be protected, and they are setting up trust for that very purpose in terms of. So they haven't got an issue which is anti-SNAs or anti-indigenous vegetation as well, because they are aware of the significance of that, the importance of it, and are taking active steps to try and do it. Just the particular one that has been identified, just to them, seems a bit crazy in the area that it is, and subsequently with the rules that are subsequently brought up, which weren't in at the time about irrigation and being
interference.
I think
the vegetation
came on
to not be here anymore,
so. I think it is, surprisingly enough. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Slade. I'll adjourn to Thomas. Thank you.